Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Greetings and welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. I'm Casey Green. I'm the founder of the Campus Computing Project and previously the moderator of the 2Degree podcast sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm standing in for John this morning for this Office Hours conversation as we're going to turn the mic on John. Office Hours launched a year ago in January 2022, and this podcast is the 61st in the session. So kind of like a year-end exam at the end of a year-long course, we're going to turn the tables on John and talk with him about his Office Hours experience and what he's learned from these 60 conversations. John, welcome to your podcast.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to attending one of my podcasts.
All right. So, John, let's move quickly into the conversation. Let's begin with the origin story. Podcasts have proliferated. Why a podcast, John? Why a podcast at this time?
Well, I tried my hand at blogging. I was a blogger for 9 years. I wrote 375 postings in 9 years, and I got to the point where I just felt I didn't have anything more to say. And that's very unusual because I almost always have something more to say. So I thought, well, maybe I would have more to say if I listened more. And I decided to do something I hadn't done, which was to try to host a podcast series. And I remember, you know, as you get older, as you well know, you look for things to do that you enjoy and you think you're good at. And when I was younger, I learned to be a professional interviewer, and I enjoyed it immensely. I was a psychiatric social worker in an Air Force psychiatric clinic, and I wasn't gaining enjoyment at the unhappiness and depression and anxiety of my Vietnam War colleagues. I enjoyed their stories, and every interview was a story. And so I thought about creating a series of podcasts that would really be stories about the lives of people whom I respected, who had done important, innovative work to influence higher education. And I wanted to do something that was consistent with the brand, quote unquote, of the nonprofit organization of which I'm a co-founder, that is, you know, promoting innovation in improving undergraduate education. And so I wanted to try to capture the voices for posterity. And I hate to say it, but I've already had one of the 61 interviewees that I interviewed died. And I am so glad I captured her while she was still living. She was a wonderful authority on how to improve the uses we make of trustees and why people become trustees and why they matter, and also chief financial officers. That's a long story about how she got to know about those. But anyway, and I've been interviewing, I've had one interview with, 58 people, but one person I've had three interviews with who is near the end of his life. And I'm exploring in all of these conversations what motivates people to innovate. And this person is motivated by a set of life experiences, but most recently, because unlike most of us, he knows pretty well how much longer he's got to live, and he doesn't have very long. And
John, let me pick up on this theme.
Yeah.
You've done talk with 58 people. You've had 60 podcast sessions.
Yes.
What are the three or four top learnings, if you will, as you think about these sessions over the past year? You know, that sort of scream out at the top of their voice, at the top of the voices of the people you've talked with from these conversations. Your participants have been all over the map in terms of titles, institutional sectors, background experiences, other things, you know, but broadly defined within the sphere of American higher education. Three or four top learnings, John.
I hated it when I saw you want to ask me for three or four because I want to give you far more than that. I rarely can say anything.
Three or four, John.
I know. Well, I think I've learned what I wanted to learn, which is that innovation, at least a process for innovation, can be taught. It can be learned. Mm-hmm. It can be replicated. I've learned you have to have a high tolerance for risk. I've learned that most innovators don't do this alone. They have, like in successful marriages, they have support groups. I'm learning even more than I ever knew that because this is focused on higher education, that we're in a culture that's really a paradox. It both inhibits our innovation because it's 1,000 years old, and it incentivizes and rewards innovation. I'm learning how powerful external stimuli are. The first one I learned about was Sputnik, 1957, and COVID is an analogy to that. And I'm fascinated by what these innovators are talking about trying to sustain from their innovations of the COVID period. Very important for me to learn that innovation is not a function of your power, your power position. No. I've interviewed a lot of people who are not really senior positions, although I have interviewed a lot of senior people. It's not a function of age. I've been interviewing people in all age ranges, and it's a function of what I call the roller bag moment for me. And that is, I invented something that I innovated something that was kind of like a roller bag because everybody could use it. Everybody could participate in it. Everybody could have their own version of it, but nobody had invented it before. And it met a need. And that for me, it was the ability to convene literally hundreds of thousands of people over 50 years in a conversation that people weren't having before then, when that was, it's about what we call the first year experience.
I want to talk about these innovators, John. Let's talk about a culture of innovation, because that's ultimately what you're talking about. That this is not the great man, the great woman kind of thing that makes it happen. There's lots of moving parts. As you think about these conversations and you think about your own experience, how does a leader create a culture that fosters innovation? What are the necessary elements of that culture and that infrastructure?
Well, sometimes the leader can't create the culture. The leader's, right. Leader's inherited a culture in which he or she finds him or herself, mm-hmm. where innovation is encouraged and rewarded and incentivized and appreciated, or at least tolerated for some. Others, they didn't initially have that culture, but they created one because they got into a position of power where they could sponsor others. And that in turn regenerates for them and keeps them in association with other innovators who, keeps the whole process rolling. So there's a tremendous amount of variety here. You're asking about the culture of innovation. Well, one of the things I do every year that I recommend to everybody is that they read the biographies of the Nobel Prize recipients. And these men and women have a great deal in common in that they're being recognized much later in their lives, often for things which they did a long time ago. Some of them get recognized for something they do very immediately, but generally this work has been a long time coming and they stayed with it. They didn't deviate. And some of the people I've interviewed are people that I really admire because they're doing something that, of course, I thought about but decided not to do, namely be a college or university president. And I decided that, a lot of the innovators that I really respect the most are people that didn't get pushed into something that would be so demanding and overwhelming and distracting, they couldn't focus on what could be their most innovative work. One of the people I interviewed, John Whiteley from the University of California, Irvine, he told me 40 years ago that if I wanted to have a meaningful career, I had to, quote, stay out of other people's meetings. I had to manage my life and my time in such a way that I would have a sufficient locus of control and support from the people I worked for to pursue innovation. And one of the persons I've interviewed in this year was a gentleman, a very distinguished former college president and president of the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, Art Levine, who told me in 1988, I was 44 years old, and I'll never forget it. He told me that I would never really have an impact on American higher education unless I became a college president. And I decided not to do that. Although I've interviewed 21 chief executive officers out of the 58 people. And because I am fascinated with what the ones whom I most admire, what do they do to maintain innovative abilities and initiatives while all these other demands are being made of them. Truly one of the most difficult jobs I can possibly imagine, and one I've never had. I've been a CEO of a nonprofit organization, not the same as an institutional president.
John, so, I want to come back to something you said a couple minutes ago. You said risk. Higher education hates risk as an overall attribute of the culture. You know, we give a lot of lip service to innovation. We give a lot of lip service to recognizing, rewarding, in theory, innovative faculty members and innovative campus administrators. But actually, the culture, I think it's fair to say at large, works against innovation, works against risk, doesn't tolerate ambiguity. How do we break through that?
Well, I guess one way is to show that there are rewards for people who break out of that and don't pursue the same patterns in their upward career mobility and get recognized for it and applauded. And that's much more likely to happen if the innovations they've developed have significant redeeming social value, that have significant positive impact on, in this case, higher education, and especially on our students. I was promoted to a full professor having done only one book. I have produced more books, if that's the, you know, because that's the, you know, most common metric of upward mobility for at least the faculty, after I was promoted to full professor than before. Because, you know, once you get to that point, it sounds paradoxical, but you don't have as much to prove theoretically. But I had a lot more years to stay focused and learn. But I wasn't, but I had to do the publishing in order to get rewarded initially. But after that, I did it for more intrinsic reasons, especially because I thought the work I did in publishing would influence others, because in the academy, publication is still the coinage of the realm. But everything I've written, with the exception of one book that's about to be published, I've done with others. As a matter of fact, it's hard for me to think of an innovation that I've pursued that I haven't done for with others. I've been a spokesperson, the primary spokesperson, for a number of innovations, but all of them I did with others. It's been a group process.
And yet the evaluation process for faculty members, and in many cases for administrators, is limited to you, as opposed to recognition and reward for collaboration.
You are the solitary expert. You know more about this topic than anybody else in the world, and you can gather people who attest to that fact. Yes, for many of academics, it's a very solitary lifestyle. It's like being, a monastic cell. But that's not been the way I wanted to pursue this.
John, I want to turn to the kind of the macro about these 60 conversations and the 58 podcasts. So, what have you learned about the current state of American higher education from these conversations? You know, you launched these in the middle of the pandemic, period of, I think it's fair to say, another crisis for American higher education. You have lots of different ways that campuses responded to this. And yet, sort of here we are. In many ways, the pandemic accelerated some innovation. It locked in some other stuff. It highlighted, kind of ripped the Band-Aid off, if you will, not just in education, but in healthcare, a lot of issues about critical infrastructure that we didn't have and that we didn't attend to, not just in terms of hardware and software and services, but also in HR, a people infrastructure that we desperately need. What have you learned?
Well, I've learned a great deal in these 60 or so conversations, and I've learned that I thought I knew most of these people, but I've learned that there's an awful lot about every one of them that I didn't know that made me respect them even more, and that to really understand innovation, you've got to drill down and get a hold of the person's whole life development to see how they did this work and what of that has been is replicable. You know, I've learned that in many of the places now in the academy, innovation is being encouraged, but still discouraged in others. I've confirmed that it's alive and well. And the field that I'm trying to innovate is, which mainly as we call now the student success, increasing the probability of more students completing higher education, and especially those students for whom higher education was not designed. you know, I've had confirmed that we've ignored the most central people of this enterprise in many ways, namely the faculty, and they're central because they have the most contact with students, and that now there are more innovations that are trying to get them more involved. A lot of the innovations after the Higher Education Act of 1965 were driven by administrators who turned to staff people that they could give direct orders, because those people didn't have tenure, to bring about changes in the academy. But that only goes so far, because the characteristics of the academy that are hardest to change and most deeply ingrained are those that are governed by the faculty. So a lot of the innovation that I've been interested in pursuing and discovering is innovation that involves faculty, and in turn has therefore a direct impact on students.
John, I want to interrupt you, because you've hit something that critics highlight about American higher education during this period. And that is, you know, if faculty are central to this, faculty numbers, at least full-time faculty numbers and tenure track positions, are overwhelmingly down during this period, and administrative positions have exploded.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what does that say about faculty as being the central force for innovation?
Well, it says that we're following healthcare, and the power in healthcare was once exercised by the physicians. And now it's not. It's being exercised by hospital administrators, and especially insurers and lawyers. And the faculty class is being displaced by administrators and by non-tenured, non-permanent appointees. Why is that happening? Well, one argument is economic. They're cheaper in the sense that they don't have a lifetime contract. They can be reassigned. They can be terminated at will. They are being replaced by people who don't stay as long and constantly change jobs, and therefore institutions are not stuck with the longer ever increasing salaries of those folks. They're also being replaced because the faculty can say no. The faculty can vote no confidence. The faculty have more autonomy and independence and academic freedom. And they're being replaced because increasingly colleges and universities are being run by they're being run on a more capitalist corporate model, where the primary criteria for most all decision making is the revenue consequences, and how can we generate more revenue from various actions that we take.
And that's also been marked, at least in the public sector, by a huge decline in terms of state support for public higher education. You know, at one point, some, you know, you go back to the Higher Education Act or even the years afterwards, 50, 60, 70% of the operating funds for public institutions varying by states came from the state. You know, we are in some cases down to 10, 12, even less in some states in terms of that operating contribution. I mean, in some ways, we're sort of back to the notion of the library in River City from the musical Music Man, you know, who owns the books and who owns the building kind of thing.
Well, every society has only so much resources that are deemed valuable, and we're making other choices, national defense.
Well, and there's also more competition for those resources.
Absolutely.
Other social services have expanded, or demand for that has expanded.
Including prisons. The number of people we're locking up instead of putting in college. You know, we don't regard a college education as a human right. We don't regard healthcare in that care, or preschool education. I'm involved with Peter Felton from Elon University and co-founding something called the Global Forum for Student Success. And one of the things that we're gathering are other colleagues who believe that higher education ought to be one of the most sustainably viewed resources of any society, and that it ought to be a birthright. It ought to be.
Well, at one time it was. Go back to 1948 and the Truman Commission, higher education to serve American democracy.
Right. And that's one of the things that I feel we're not doing enough of right now, is to use higher education to preserve and protect democracy. We become afraid of it. Even some of us who have tenure, I feel that some of the greatest hope and responsibility for preserving and protecting, at least for me, what's good about higher education rests with those of us who are tenure. And if we don't use that freedom and autonomy, we're all sunk. And study American society, for example, the inhibitions on studying the consequences of gun use in this country. Mm-hmm. Shameful. We can't inform the American public of what the consequences of this really are.
Now, I want to turn to your book. So you mentioned you've got a book coming out, A Metaphorical Sin of Omission, given that this is your podcast. not to give you an opportunity to take a few moments for some shameless self-promotion. In full disclosure, I saw an early version of the book, and I've characterized the book as essentially documenting your personal journey and chronicling the first year experience movement that launched at the University of South Carolina. Sure. So I'm going to give you a couple of moments for a little bit of shameless self-promotion, which you should take and enjoy, to talk about the book titled Launching the First Year Experience Movement.
Well, I got into this because one reason was I had an editor, David Brightman, who is my editor at both Josie Bass and now, thankfully, with Stylus Publishing, who encouraged me to do this. And I'd done a number of books previously with David. And the part of writing anything is the relationship with your editor, your mentor in that respect, and the pleasure that can come from that and the learning. But I did it to try to inspire others at different points in their career. I definitely want to reach people who are earlier in their career, and also those that have gained a lot of power and could do far more to help students whom, as I said previously, for whom college was not designed. And I've learned from my students in working with students that stories empower others, and we all have stories, and I want to try and empower others. And I'm trying especially to empower people who, well, no, I don't want to say especially. I want to inspire people who don't come from privilege and who have had to overcome enormous obstacles. A number of the people I've interviewed for the podcast, I've interviewed five incredible Black Americans who have overcome extraordinary challenges to become college presidents. But I also have interviewed and want to reach people who were born into more privilege rather than those of us who have less privilege and who have even more ability to influence the outcomes. And I want to get more of them aboard for what I call the unfinished civil rights movement. And I am a product of the 60s. I lost my first job. I was fired in my first job for higher education. I was fired in my first job in higher education because of my civil rights work. After I got out of the Air Force, I had an honorable discharge, a coveted thing for men in the 1960s and early 70s. And I had no debt. I had no spouse, no children, and I could do anything I wanted. And one of the things I wanted to be involved in was the civil rights movement, and it cost me my job. And I wanted to get to the point ultimately, and thank goodness I've had that opportunity, to have more personal power and autonomy and job security where I could continue to make contributions to that movement and to inspire others to do so who have also that kind of power. The book is about how young people acquire in college a core set of values and beliefs on which they base their lives. And for me, it was discovering in a liberal arts education the meaning of justice and how do some people get more or less justice, and what could I, as one American citizen, do to help others achieve more justice. And for me, it was about helping more freshmen, first-year students, find justice through higher education and to find others who wanted to bring that along. It was also about being inspired by, you know, being my first college teaching was in rural, southern, poor environments. Poor, that is, our students were poor, first generation textile mill workers, et cetera. And also recreating the kind of opportunity I never thought I would see there, but I did in the military, which was an incredible social experiment to create a much better way of life for citizens who wouldn't have had that better way of life.
A lot of personal stories in the book. I learned that.
Correct.
And some of them are quite troubling, but they're also a throwback to what those times were 15, 16 years ago.
I use a lot of voices and language of the times.
Yeah. All right. So, John, I usually close interviews, whether they're public or if I'm doing field work, by recognizing I'm not omniscient. So in that context, what questions haven't I asked you? What topics haven't we touched on as we take these kind of final closing minutes for this conversation and for you to reflect back on the 60 interviews that have been part of this podcast series?
Well, you haven't asked me where I think we must go.
Okay.
Education. I've suggested.
Where must we go then, John?
Well, as I said previously, we need to be far more proactive about protecting and preserving this mm-hmm. nation's democracy, or we're going to lose it. We have to produce people who are willing to challenge and think critically and get involved in civic matters and run for office to improve the social good. I think we also have got to do something to restore the human value equation mm-hmm. to offset the values we use to run businesses in making our decisions. We're really losing the focus on the dignity of the students at issue and what they must learn and be able to do. We're just so obsessed with using the academy to make money. I think we've got to provide more incentives for innovation. You didn't ask me about that, and that's okay. You also didn't ask me, what am I going to do next? Where am I going with the work? And because I don't have very many hobbies and I like to work and my employer is still willing to have me work, I'm working with a small group of other colleagues right now to launch a new initiative on the graduate student experience to try to help.
Well, there are just huge human resource losses along at each point along the pipeline. If we were to create a parallel world and use some of the same analytic models for graduate education that we do for undergraduate education, we'd be even more appalled by those attrition rates and those losses.
Absolutely. I will try in the time I've got left to do something about that. I'm also trying to act in the manner opposite that our former president, who left office in 2021, showed the world, to make America first. There's no question. I'm a very serious patriot. I was volunteered for the armed forces, proud to have served my country. I think I've been serving my country for the next 56 years in American higher education. But I'm taking a number of actions right now to get more involved with other educators around the globe who, like me, are pursuing this thing we call student success. And I want to keep writing. These interviews I've been doing, I'm asking myself, didn't have time to do this justice here, of course, that's not possible in the podcast context, but what have I been learning? And what are the lessons I want other people to learn who can't listen to 60 podcasts or 120 or how many, 300, 400, how many am I ever going to be able to do? So I'm trying to think, well, what can I extract from that and write about that could be more economically shared with others? So, and I'm sure
that's a good way to end, John, in terms of the challenge continues as opposed to ends. So my thanks to you for your willingness to sit on the other side of the table and the other side of the microphone to kind of,
you know, I admire you and would enjoy anything I'd do with you.
Take some time to reflect.
You are one of those who inspired me to, you were the person who inspired me to do this. You've been my mentor. I would not have done this.
That's very
you.
Kind, John.
Very few original ideas that I've had. I've gotten most all of them from others like you.
It speaks to the value of collaboration, that the sum is more than the parts.
Absolutely.
All right. Great. With that, we're going to end this 61st podcast and return Office Hours with John Gardner back to John Gardner for podcast number 62. Thank you, John.
I look forward to that, too.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute, and we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.